Well, then we are on time.
Yeah, no, it's great. We're
okay,
doing pretty good.
So we've got Matt Keller here from Vice President of CoreSec Security, who's going to be running this panel on future security. So, Matt?
I actually put it in my booklet. I don't know if
I guess. Hello, and thank you, everyone. I appreciate this chance to chat with you and bring together this panel. Actually, we're short a mic.
Solution is being worked on.
Can you hear me? Does that work? Try again. Huh. I thought if I stole it, it would work. It's a little bit small.
Yeah. We can share.
Yeah, we'll just share this mic over here.
All right, you sure?
I'll speak loudly. Right. Yeah.
It's harder to have a conversation if you're constantly shifting the mic around. So, all right. So welcome, everyone. Appreciate you all being here. I want to take just a second to introduce myself, and then I'll introduce the other members of the, or let them introduce themselves. It's a little more interesting to hear them introduce themselves than me reading a little script. But just real quick, my name's Matt Keller. I'm a vice president at CoreSec Security. I've been doing FIPS and Common Criteria evaluations for about 16, 17 years. And during that time, I've seen a lot of modules go by, been to a lot of these conferences. My job at CoreSec has changed a number of different times. Right now I do a lot of partnership management. But with that, let me pass it over to Bob.
Okay. Hi everybody, my name is Bob Burns. I'm the CSO at Talisi Security. I have been doing security in some form or fashion longer than I'd like to admit, so let's just say 20 plus years. I was started as a software engineer, but caught the security bug very early on, and I've been very fortunate to work for a number of different companies, being able to express that passion in the security domain. And as a member of the technical directorate at Talis, I get to influence and control all the technology we build, as well as everything that we certify.
Okay. Hi, my name is Gaurav Arora. I am in the CT office, Director of Technology. If you can't hear me, just tell me that from the back. So I've been in the industry for also longer than I care to admit, about 20 plus years. Security in the last, officially in the last five or six, but early in my career was probably doing things that I shouldn't admit to in public. In the CTO office, we are influencing the portfolio of our identity and protection portfolio. Gemalto has a very wide range of offerings, and it's always fun to see what's happening new and how we can bring that into the company and change the security landscape. So that's me.
Hi everyone, my name is Jasper van Woudenberg, or Jasper if you want to do it Americanized. I've been doing security professionally since about 16 years now, so first in the software space and then in the hardware space, always on the breaking side of things. So I don't make security, I just break it. So my job is actually easier than these two guys' job. I just need to find a few flaws and then I can go home. I got into the space because I, when I was a teenager, I sucked at video games, and I found it was actually easier to break the saved state of the games to increase my own lives than to complete the games the proper way. So that's how I got into this space. Now I've done a lot of software initially. Now with Riskier, we're doing obviously a lot more embedded system security, so that includes software and hardware and all the fancy side channel and fault injection stuff you've been hearing about as well. I think that's sufficient for now.
Perfect. All right, thanks. And I appreciate all of you taking the time to participate in this. It's nice to have a group of CTOs, CSOs, going through a set of questions. We have a really narrow topic. If you remember, it's the future of security. So I hope we can find something to talk about over the next hour. We'll see. But before we get to asking these guys questions, I would like to ask you all a question. I'm not going to ask you to identify yourself as Whit Diffie, but I did want to ask, just by show of hands, I'm curious, who do you think is going to end up bearing the brunt of the massive cyber attacks or the bulk of cyber attacks over the next several years? Do you think it'll be more nation states under attack, or do you think it'll be more private sector corporations that are under attack? So those that think it'll be the nation states getting the brunt of those attacks, can you show me show of hands? Okay, very, very few. Okay, on the private sector side, we think that's the trouble area. All right, well, all right, there we go. Sounds good. Yeah. There's a problem? No, there's an opportunity, absolutely. So let me ask my first question to our panel here. I read an article recently that said Moore's Law is starting to break down. You know, he had initially postulated it would be every year, it would be doubling, then he changed that about 5 or 10 years later, said, oh, it'll be every 2 years, and now there's just a point where things are getting so small in the physics of it all, we're not doubling in compute capacity and the size shrinking. What do you think the implications are for the security space with this maybe potential decrease in the acceleration of compute power? How do you think that will impact security products, the security industry?
Yeah, coming from an attacker perspective, which I am, I think it might actually balance out. So what I've been seeing is, on the one hand, Moore's Law, at least in the past, have given security vendors a lot of more opportunity to implement security measures. But on the flip side, it also gives attackers more power to actually break solutions, especially when you look at big number, like side channel or cryptographic attacks. It's a lot of big number crunching. You know, when I started doing side channel stuff 10 years ago, we were very excited we could capture a 4 or 5 gigabyte trace set. Now my guys in my lab are excited if they capture a 4 or 5 terabyte trace set. So within 10 years, we've gone up a factor 1,000 in terms of attacker capability. But obviously, on the flip side, and maybe these guys can talk more to that, the shrinking and making everything more cheap also means you can implement more countermeasures. Mm. I don't know if you guys have some opinions there.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. After you.
I was going to say that I think what I see from a security perspective, what we're seeing is because of the slowdown of the capability of the central processing of the main CPU, mm-hmm. what you see is a distribution of that power. You see that coming out in the virtual environments. So the mere fact that so much power is now commoditized, you can see all of these Amazons of the world and Microsofts of the world set up these huge server farms, do that, and then it distributes out to the endpoints where we get the IoT. So you can move so much more computing power to the endpoints. What we're seeing is a huge increase in the surface area of potential attack. So it's completely changing the dynamics of thinking about a central resource that is very confined, that you can put very defined defensive perimeters around and constrain in a certain way such that you can limit the types of attacks that would be launched against it. And now we've exploded that. We've taken all of these pieces, moved it out to the edge. We've taken a single compute unit and divided it up into 1,000 pieces, each one of which requires defensive mechanisms around to be able to protect. And now each one of your neighbors becomes an attack vector, becomes a point at which you can jump from point A to point B on the same CPU in the same memory space. So it's completely, it's increased the complexity, at least from my as a defensive perspective, of what we have to try to do and the types of threats we're worried about. You've seen a lot of advancements in the attack space around memory attacks, cache memory attacks, cache timing attacks, being able to locate a virtual machine in a server farm down to specifically who your neighbors are. There's a lot of really interesting research, but these are the things that keep me up at night. these are the things that cause me to lose sleep is the, oh my God, how are we going to actually mitigate that particular type of a threat if we want to operate in those environments? Now, primarily as an HSM vendor, it's somewhat comforting because we get to create a cocoon. We get to create a box that lives somewhere and that we can control somewhat what goes around it. But that's not where our customers are going. Our customers are going out into the virtual world. They're going out to the edge of the IoT. They're starting to proliferate into these environments, and they want to know how are they going to remain secure? And just like you can't apply SSL just to any solution, you also can't take the HSMs and move them out to the perimeter. You can't just take everything and put an HSM in it, and all of a sudden you get magical key management. That's not how that works.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more intricate than that.
Yeah.
I think there's also an opportunity there, though.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're moving some of the security actually from the endpoints into the cloud means that you can manage it on the cloud side. So you have a little bit more flexibility in what you can do in terms of upgrades, in terms of attack detection, than if it was purely endpoint-based.
That is funny, right, because you got centralization because you're throwing things in the cloud. You got decentralization as you've got IoT being spread out everywhere.
Yeah. Right, and now, you know, just going with what Bob was saying is, yeah, we've got now smart cards and more secure elements on the endpoints, right? So we've got more, quote-unquote, roots of trust being out there. But what's interesting is that I don't think that there's just a big technology play here, right? Kind of talking about the fact that what our customers, as a vendor, we have a hard problem of how are we going to protect against quantum attacks or what have you, right? The new attacks that are going to come out there. But ultimately, when you look at the breach index, right, Gemalto tracks this, all the breaches across that are disclosed in this breach level index, and if you look at it, these breach index are not because folks are spending lots and lots of time trying to break into someone's key. They're just looking for gaps in implementation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So no matter how much technology we're throwing at it, the smartest minds are always going to find a way to build a better mousetrap,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be someone equally on the other side going to be able to figure out how to break into that mousetrap, but bulk of it's going to be the fact that someone just left the key next to the mousetrap or something like that, right? and it just didn't work out. So I think that's the biggest fear, if you will, is how do you educate and implement that out
mm-hmm.
as things are exploding, as customers are going from a centralized to a decentralized way, in a way that is going to be secure, no matter, for at least 80% use case. The 20%, that's also another problem.
It's interesting, you talked a little bit about how the compute landscape is changing, where you've got centralization in some ways, decentralization, but another way that I think it's changing is, while compute power may not be up and to the right as steep as it was, the expectation of product release cycle, I feel, is just speeding up. Where, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier today, like in some cases, you know, products are sent out daily. So here's your daily update. Could you guys talk a little bit about the impacts of that, both from the attack perspective, but also from the build perspective now? How is that impacting the security or security evaluation even with this very quick release cycle?
So I'll go first. So just from a security release perspective, from our perspective, it used to be when we're building a hardware device, we could assume that hardware device is going to be in, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years. But now, I mean, if you're looking at a phone which has got a secure element, some sort of technology in there, that only has a lifespan for maybe a couple years, you know, before people want to throw that out. So how much effort do you put into certifications and following all of that when you know your device only has a limited shelf life? How much do we think of shifting away from a hardware into a software landscape? How do we move it from, you know, building products that, you know, kind of go through security life cycle once and then they're just launched out, to kind of going through the DevOps, the SecOps side of now that we have to do continuous delivery of some security service in the cloud? How are we as a vendor going to make sure our customers are protected? Right, so some of the things that we think about of securing tomorrow's world.
Yeah, I think as development life cycles speed up, security testing should somehow speed up as well, right? That's the only implication really that you have there. but that's difficult when it comes to certification, because
mm-hmm.
Certifications are actually not built to be very agile. They're actually built to be somewhat stable over a couple of years so you can build towards them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the real tricky part is that an attacker doesn't care about certification, right? We care, but the attacker doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So as products get updated from a security perspective, that's good because you can respond to whatever threat you have in the field. It's really difficult. So again, I have the easy job here. These guys need, so you're talking about mobile phones being in the field for a couple of years. if you're talking about automotive, a chip needs to be in the field for, what, 20 years? And those things are getting connected now, too.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's really a balance that you need to strike between how much am I going to put in hardware, which is not updatable,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be in the field for 20 years, versus software, which is updatable, but arguably easier to break, at least today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, yeah, again, I don't luckily need to make that balance, but I do see that challenge in my customers, right?
Mm-hmm.
They and there's no, obviously no one size fits all answer here.
Yeah.
Because in different, like if you are designing something for mobile, yeah, you only need to take a few years into account. If you're designing for automotive, that balance works out really differently.
You hit on something that I think is interesting, which is the balance of hardware and software. I know each of the product vendors here, you make hardware and software solutions. What's better? Is there a right balance? Is it better to have a hardware solution, better to have a software solution? I heard some of the pros and cons, but how do you kind of decide how that balance is going to be struck?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a very interesting question. For those who saw John Geeter, my colleague John's talk this morning, you know, he made a very big point about software eating the world. And that's exactly true, because to scale, to be able to move at the speed at which the markets are moving,
mm-hmm.
We need to be able to move rapidly with them. Hardware doesn't facilitate that. So you have to make that trade-off of deciding, you know, what sorts of hardware capabilities do you need and have, and how do you leverage that to enable all of the software capabilities that you need and have. So somewhat trailing back to the last question, there is a, outside of certification, there is a non-zero cost that someone has to incur to deploy a product securely. So outside of the certification rigor, there is a certain amount of rigor that you're going to employ at the engineering level just to go that extra mile to build in that additional security capabilities, those mitigations, the additional security testing that you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we're never going to be able to move as fast as the rest of the world because we're doing more to provide that higher level of assurance. And then you roll the certifications on top of that,
mm-hmm.
As my other colleague Fabian's presentation earlier highlighted, you know, some certifications can roll quickly, others not so much. But that does put our customers in a very interesting position. So let's suppose we can move quick enough to patch and provide these updates. Then our customers are the ones who have to choose between either having a patched version of software that's not certified or an unpatched version that is certified. So we're kind of pushing that decision out to them, and I think that's unfair. So as a group, I think we've got to get better at being able to make sure that our security is baked in at the software layer much lower in
mm-hmm.
and much more frequently, so that we can move more rapidly and build the actual services and solve the problems that our customers actually want us to solve. Because it may come as a shock to some of you in here. No customer has ever walked up to me and said, I really, really just would love a big piece of hardware sitting in my infrastructure that's hard to manage and causes me headaches. No one ever wants that, right? These are solutions that we've introduced to solve a privacy problem or a confidentiality problem or an identity problem. No one ever went up and said, hey, I know it's great. Let's build a billion smart cards and provision them and send them around the world. No one ever wants that. That just happens to be what technology can provide to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to make sure that we're actually providing solutions that fit the marketplace and fit what our customers' problems actually are. And that means moving more rapidly. That means putting more emphasis on the software stack, but that conversely means putting in more mitigations to stop our friend over there from being able to come up with his clever ways of making us look bad. And that's where the challenge lies. I think that's the secret sauce, is finding that dividing line of how much of this do we have to bake in from a threat analysis standpoint, and how much of this can we offload into the software eating the world paradigm and move more quickly.
Yeah, and there you also have the difference between those endpoint devices and stuff that you run in your back end, right?
Yeah.
So the more secure architectures of entire systems assume that those endpoint devices will get compromised at some point,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where you need to be heading if you're designing entire systems.
And the funny thing is that these endpoints, because they are produced on such scale, they have to be produced cheaply. So,
mm-hmm.
so they actually are in the highest threat environment. So they face the deepest threats, but have to be the lowest cost devices out there. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard contradiction to solve, as I'm sure you're really familiar with doing. So in some ways, being on the back end is almost easier because you can concentrate more power. But you're right, the dichotomy of having to be out at the endpoint but be the most secure that you can ever be for the longest period of time is a very challenging problem to solve.
And I think also some of it is also working with industry to help commoditize what we would like. So, you know, Intel, as many of you guys know, are now doing, you know, high-speed crypto coming natively in their chips soon, mm-hmm. right? Now, what does that imply to us who build custom ASICs for that, right? So, you know, also having that influence so that we are the commoditization of the market and we're taking advantage of that, so that now they're more endpoint, right? So we're not building a box. We're just going to be using all the boxes that are out there to do the security for us and trying to see how that actually plays out in the stack and how does that work in the decentralized environment.
Mm-hmm. So, Jasper, if you've got, you come into work one day and they say,
occasionally,
you've got one of two. Yeah, occasionally. They say, you got a choice here. You can spend your day attacking this software product. You can spend your day attacking some other hardware product.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have as you think that one of them is a little easier? Is there a attack surface you would rather go after?
Ooh, that's a tough question. There's lots of depends in that sense. Well, one thing is for sure, if I only have one day, I would for sure go for the software. Now, an attacker brain works finding the lowest path of resistance, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, if you are presenting me with a simple microcontroller mm-hmm. with a nicely secure boot on there mm-hmm. And all kinds of promises about crypto but no side channel countermeasures, I'm just going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're presenting me with a super hardened smart card, I might just have to fire up some of the most exotic attacks that I have because I can discard all the easy attacks to mm-hmm. start off with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're giving me open SSL and physical access, I'll do it in a day. So, yeah, it really depends. But in the end, it's if you're asking for my personal preference, for now, it's still probably tend towards hardware attacks, mm-hmm. even though my roots lie in software.
Mm-hmm. It seems like you get to play with better toys with the hardware attacks.
Absolutely, yeah. Lasers beat keyboard any day.
Yeah.
So, Jasper, I have a question there. You triggered something interesting. You had mentioned if you got a smart card, you would discard a bunch of tests immediately.
Yeah.
Does that imply that somehow that certification narrows your focus of vision of what you're going to test? In other words, can you, because something has a CC or a FIPS, that you immediately take a class of attacks off the table and make your actual directed attack quicker?
Yeah, so I didn't want to tie it directly to certifications, but certification do give you some, it's advertised on the sticker, right? Yeah. So it gives you some resistance to certain classes of attacks. I was thinking more when you're actually in the process of doing certification. So, for instance, in a Common Criteria or EMVCO, you go through this phase called a vulnerability assessment,
yeah.
where you basically read up on the specs of the device and you decide what the most likely attack path is. So you do that based on what you read, but also the experience you have in, you know, I know if I'm going to take any modern smart card, clock glitching is probably not going to be feasible.
Yeah.
So I can, during vulnerability analysis, of course, you'll look for the countermeasures, but those can be off the table pretty quickly. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, we've hit on certifications a little bit, and of course, that's a big piece of why we're all here. I was curious if you could talk a little bit about, is there value in seeking these certifications outside of government? So I know there are other verticals, but I'm curious how you weigh how aggressively to go after some of these certifications, given you probably sell to a breadth of different verticals, but it's usually the government that beats the drum the hardest. So, how do you make that decision?
I'm not sure if it's just government. Well, actually, I'm sure it's not just government, because we do common criteria, but also pay TV certifications a lot, mm-hmm. and for the payment industry.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty serious on their certifications. So mm-hmm. they have similar goals, right? So they want to make sure that a certain base level of security is in the products. So yeah, that's definitely across the different verticals. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think certifications are very important. I think they are market driven. I think they help highlight the different verticals and what they particularly require. I think the challenge that comes with certification is that the promise of CC never really panned out. There is, you know, the common of CC isn't really there. I think also with the aging of FIPS being an unofficial accepted international standard, the fact that it's atrophied somewhat has, what I'm seeing is that we see a lot of regional certifications popping up now, where countries and or business sectors will take something, tweak it, make it their own, and want you to get certified either as a to enter into that market or to prove your worth there. So that makes it challenging as a vendor, because now they're, the proliferation of the number of types of certifications and the breadth of which they are means that you have to make tough choices into which markets you want to enter and not. And in some ways it's self-defeating. I think that the more organizations are doing this, the more they're basically setting themselves up to compare themselves against another dollar figure somewhere else in the world, because there's only so many vendors and so much bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
And once you set yourself up, unless you can come to the table and say, our market is worth X, you're going to have a very homogeneous environment of selection of things that can meet those sets of requirements.
Mm-hmm.
But we see it as important. Our particular philosophy is we like to design secure products that can get certified, as opposed to designing a certified product. And the subtlety is somewhat different in that we want to make sure that our customer problem is solved, what they're trying to do, and hope that it aligns with what the governments think should be done, and then we try to follow mm-hmm. up that way.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of the points have been mentioned, but I think just to highlight the difference between certification and security,
mm-hmm.
right? That may be subtle, but it's significant enough to say. Mm-hmm. We've kind of talked about how the friction has, or in the evolving market of technology, is forcing certification, which is not keeping up, right? Like the FIPS and all of that, to now say, okay, how do we go faster? How do you certify things faster? How do you evolve standards quickly so that the new attacks that are being coming out are actually mitigated, so the bar keeps going up over time?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting challenge that I think has been basically come up in the last few years because of the cloud and the evolution of all of the technology that's happened. And I think it's going to be quite interesting of how the certification bodies react to that. And I think you see that starting to happen,
mm-hmm.
but I think it'll be interesting where that sort of lies and how that technology, how that certification landscape is in about 5 years or 10 years from now.
Yeah, I would certainly say just from watching certifications, I feel like, or the certification bodies, when they are more actively engaged with the, not even the end users, the vendors and the folks trying to conform to it, and maybe even in the testing labs, and there's a dialogue about what's working and what's not working, I feel like evolution happens so much faster. And I've seen periods where some of the standards we consult in, where there's been more communication or less communication, and then the times with more communication, I feel like the standards have been more quick to adjust, and it's when someone putting together standards aren't listening, and it's more dictating and less listening and interaction, I think it evolves slower. So I don't know if that's always the key to throttling it or making it go faster, but that's certainly one of the things I've seen. So, Bob, you said something interesting, which was the proliferation of other standards, and I was curious, are you speaking of other governments or just even other verticals, and how is that impacting, you, like you said, you're designing products that could be certified, but yeah. If there's 15 different things and new things popping up, how are you doing that?
Yeah, well, That's why I get paid the big bucks.
Yeah.
No, it is a challenge. So to answer your first question, there are regional governments, but there are also regional standards, for example, in the payments industry, which is somewhat fragmented across the globe as far as what they will accept and won't accept. The U.S. is particularly haphazard at the moment. There are changes going on in EMEA around payment terminals and getting common criteria on those, which has never existed before. So there's just kind of things all over the place. We still focus on the bread and butter. You know, common criteria and FIPS are the primary tip of the spear. But we see in Asian countries in particular, we see some in South America where they're taking FIPS-like approaches, where they take the document and then munge it up and then say, oh, it's just like FIPS, until it's not. So it is very challenging, and I think I'll hit on the point that he made is that much like the software world is moving very quickly, vendors are trying to play catch up. I think the certification bodies are even further behind, because the whole notion of a static certificate that represents a very ephemeral point in time in which a bunch of diligence was done. Once you start adding agile and churning and updates and quick and moving and online and IoT and all of this other stuff, all of a sudden that static point in time becomes harder to stand behind and say, yes, this is a stamp of approval that says, you know, we've done a certain amount of diligence and we have faith that this thing has done all of these requirements and is secure to some level. But if you can't keep up with those deltas or manage it in a very deterministic way, you're going to have challenges keeping the value in those certifications for your customers. So there is the risk that the markets start to outpace certifications and start to devalue them automatically, at which case then the vendors are going to be less incentivized to add that as part of their portfolio of delivering secure products into the markets. So I don't know the answer. I know we've talked to FIPS a little bit about coming up with update processes. PCI does a fairly good job, and I think some common criteria ones, depending on the protection profile in the country, can keep up. But I think we have a general pattern of a potential problem here if we don't find a way to also have the standards try to keep up with the software world.
Yeah,
I think we're going to slowly start to lose them in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. And Gaurav, Jim Alto would be the same thing. Do you feel like you're kind of, are you chasing all these standards? And is there almost like a tax on the product because you're always having to build in, I mean, not a literal tax, obviously, but you have to build in, oh, I'm going after these different certifications. There's just overhead for all those things.
We try to build secure products that can be certified, right? But there's a cost of doing the certification, both on our side and external, we're doing the labs or what have you, and keeping up with that and always maintaining that. So it comes down to just evaluating as a full business to say, okay, is it worth putting in that effort to go into that market? Is the juice worth the squeeze, sort of thing. And I just, for me, just the idea of a certificate is equivalent to having a driver's license, right? You go take a test, you get a driver's license, but then if something happens to you, right, where you have some accident and you can't see or whatever, you can't see very well, you have checks and balances, but the doctor writes a note and sends the information out saying, hey, this thing is not certified.
Yeah.
We don't have that with products, right? We get it certified, it's out there. Vulnerabilities come out. That thing is still in production. People are still using it. There's no suddenly somebody that says, the certification body says, oh, all those machines have to go offline. Right? So you basically, you have all of these things that were certified a long time ago, but they're not secure.
Yeah.
Still out there.
And I think that's the important distinction is that it's very easy to equate the word secure with certification. And that's what we hope our customers do, right? that's kind of what we want to do. But at the end of the day, we know that's not true. The world is moving. And it's very hard to go back to customers after they've deployed something to try to give them that choice, that hard choice of, hey, we fixed it, but you're not certified anymore. Or, you're certified, yay, but just ignore this open SSL bug over here.
Right.
It makes managing the customers a bit more difficult, even the security sensitive ones. It is always a challenging conversation.
So just taking us in a little different direction, since our topic is the future of security. We kind of went down certifications for a while. Let's go back to the future. Let's talk a little bit about technologies and trends that you see coming up. I feel like each of you is in a neat position where you're looking at new technology. You're looking at the things that are coming. You're at a place in the organization you can be looking ahead. I'm curious, what do you think is really going to have an impact on the security industry, either a technology or a trend or something along those lines?
Yeah, two things come to mind. So I think one we touched upon already, which is IoT type design. So you can, your system is becoming more distributed, so you can choose where to put your security. Mm-hmm. So I think there will be a lot of interesting challenges. Another thing that I see becoming more and more popular is trusted execution environments, mm-hmm. which is, for you folks who don't know, on almost everybody's smartphone nowadays, next to your iOS or your Android operating system, there's actually another operating system there, which is more or less at least advertised to be secure. And it runs some trusted applications, which can be a TPM or a payment application or any of those kind of more trusted applications that you don't want to run in a rich operating system. Which gives vendors another way to balance security against performance. So it's usually implemented on an ARM trust zone-like system, which means that there's actually a virtualized secure CPU. So in a sense, it's a logical partitioning between the what they call the normal world and the secure world, which is not a hardware physical partition, which is where we hardware security folks like to come from. So it's actually a trade-off between security and performance and power consumption and having an extra chip on your chip. I think we're going to see a lot of interesting shifts with what am I going to put in a TE? What am I going to put in a rich OS? What am I going to put in a backend? There's a lot of different combinations you can make there. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll at least keep me busy for a while.
Yeah.
And these guys too, probably.
Yeah. So that commoditization of security, which I referred to earlier, and Jasper hit on the fact that even on the back end now, with Intel SGX, is you're bringing that trusted execution environment into every server, mm-hmm. into every laptop, into every Intel chip. So now there's ways to do that trade-off even on the back end of what's going to be trusted, where are the keys going to actually do their work, where the cipher is going to actually execute, and where is the rest of the world going to exist on. Mm-hmm. And I think from an interesting technology perspective, that's very interesting, where you get trusted execution environments in every compute platform, mm-hmm. right? Now, would it trickle down to IoT? Possibly. It depends on power and size and blah, blah, blah. Not your toaster. But maybe your Fitbit eventually. But I think that's going to be very interesting, both from how it's going to force security implementations to change, mm-hmm. but I think it'll also bring new threat vectors. Because there's going to be gaps in how that's done and, gotchas about what we haven't thought about.
Yeah.
That the great minds will think, and then we'll...
Yeah, and there, at least we are really seeing now these things, like certification and TEs go head-to-head now. Because TE, that's a software solution, right? You can update that over the air. Payment industry wants to make use of that for their payment application, so they want to have it certified. Mm-hmm. So how do you now balance the discussion we had earlier about certification versus agility of updates?
What's interesting too is both of you end up mentioning a trust element, some trusted component in the mobile device, a TPM or some trusted. We've been striving for that trust for so long, and we're trying to build in. No, really, here's something you really could trust, and then what could you build off of that, and mm-hmm. how does that change? So it's interesting that in both of those computing environments, that's what you mentioned.
Yeah, it's important in security to have trusted partitions, right? That's mm-hmm. that's one of the fundamentals.
Yeah.
So I think from I think I'll take a slightly different tact. it's kind of a negative trend, and I don't know what the solution is. But what I'm seeing in the security world is there is a great deal of emphasis on the attack, on the offensive side of security. So there seems to be a lot of really good smart people thinking about ways to break things in very creative ways. And there's not a proportionate amount of effort being spent on the defensive side. We tend to be reactive, so we wait for clever folks like Jasper to find a problem, and then we go off and think and go, oh, but if we just did this, here's a defensive measure. With the proliferation of IoT and trust points going out, if we don't have the secure patterns and the design elements in place for our developers, the software guys and gals, to be able to lay down this foundation of defensive security as part of something integral to what they're doing, we're just going to keep scaling. What's going to happen is we're just going to proliferate layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of software. You know, all the clever folks that are doing things today are doing it this far away from the hardware, right? Mm-hmm. You know, X number of stacks. And they all assume the layer below them did the right thing and is doing the right thing or is responsible for deploying the defensive measures. If we keep going down that path, you know, we're going to just end up in this cyber mess of all of these things that can talk to each other that just become trampolines to the next thing that's broken.
And lots of finger pointing.
and lots of finger pointing. So I love the hacking. I love the things that are going on, but it's easy to forget. If you look at the news, everybody's focusing on PII, personal information, leaking out. But we see with things like the Swift attack, you know, that was $1 billion with a B that was going to be transferred in an instant and only stopped because of a spelling mistake. And that's not going to be the last one. There's real money to be lost here. There's real things that are going to break in these software stacks. It's not just defacing a website. It's not just doing a ransomware Trojan. It really is. There's a lot of things that can get lost. And I personally think one of the things that we underreport on right now is IP theft. So the news is all about, you know, whose credit card got stolen or Target getting X number of records stolen because it impacts the people who are watching the news.
Right.
But the companies are never incentivized once they find out IP has been stolen to stand up and say, hey, guess what? All our IP was stolen.
Right. Right?
Generally, they put the rug over it and go, and that's a much bigger cost to our societies. And that comes from being very good at attacking, but not very good at defending. And software is running everything that we're doing these days, from everything in our corporate infrastructure, to everything in your pocket, to everything, your payday, you know, getting your direct deposit, you know, paying your bills. Everything goes through some digital network these days. And if we can't start improving the security layers in the stack, it's a trend that I think is going to have some negative consequences.
Well, it's interesting, too. Like, there is a focus on the negative, right? Like, the guy that solved four or five different vulnerabilities and whatever thing, they don't get a logo like Heartbleed, or they don't get, like, you know, press, you know, it's like, no, I solved a bunch of stuff and nothing happened, so.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's my big, you know, big press release?
Reward, so, right, exactly.
Yeah. So we do have a little bit of time. I wanted to give you all a chance to ask this group some questions. The topic is the future of security. So whatever you're thinking about, if you could come up to the mic and ask your question, we'd love to hear it. Yeah, let's find out.
Traffic jam.
Hi, guys. Just take a bit off what Bob was saying towards the end there. What do you think the future is, the basics? I keep advocating that where I work.
Yeah.
As you said, everybody's really focused on cyber, all the new stuff. What can I put in place to stop the bad guys? Is it going to be a vertical or horizontal attack? What's going to happen with the X, Y, and Z? When in fact, they haven't patched the latest, gateway, OS, firewall. I figure, really, if you don't have the basics taken care of, the rest is irrelevant. And I feel that we're failing really badly with that. And I'm talking about, like, I don't care about the patching. Yeah, very important. Code reviews, quality control, revisions to make sure, is that the right module? Is it still certified? Can we check? Is there a hole in this? All those things. What's your
I completely agree. I think the basics are easy to get wrong, though, unfortunately, in today's agile world. You know, every 4 or 5 years, we have a new generation of developers coming out of the universities who are taught the steady state of how to make a light flash or make a, you know, an API call work. They're not taught to think about what are the negative ramifications and what are the exception paths. You mentioned good things like code reviews and static analysis, and all of those things are great. But I think everyone in this room can probably put their hand up a million times for all the times that those things still let stuff through, right? So there is no replacement for applying the right rules. So as I said, I think there's a lot of energy in the attack side. We don't have as much energy in the clever people thinking about the ways in which we can build the border fences and the defenses and the processes and the basic things that we do every day and make it in a usable way that it doesn't impede developers or make their workload 5 times greater than it would be if they didn't think about it. Because that's where we are today. You know, thinking about those hard problems makes something take 5 times longer. And you go tell an agile team, oh, by the way, here's 5 other things you're going to do that's going to make your velocity go down like this, but it's okay, it'll be secure. You're going to have a mass exodus. So the question is, are we putting too much onus on there? Can we do things at the chip level, you know, like do not execute, make that more common, make that more built in, you know, slide that bar on the hardware side, mm-hmm. where we work on the compilers and the hardware level such that we make it harder for the developers to do things wrong and give them the degrees of freedom to innovate and do the fun things and do the cool new ways of connecting and communicating and turning on switches and reading sensors that doesn't expose them to those types of threats.
My question actually would be, why does an entire system come down when I get the basics wrong? Why do I not build in some kind of resilience? I think that's what we're also missing. Like, people are going to make mistakes. There's going to be a firewall misconfigured. You know, Target was hacked through the air conditioning interface, I believe. Why is the system architected in such brittle way, in a sense, that one small basic mistake makes everything come down? You know, that security in layers, defense in depth, I think that's what we need to think about at an architectural level when we're designing systems.
They're just not taught that way. I mean, again, if I go back to my college days, I was trained as a software engineer, yeah. Right? You know, you do the happy dance as soon as your loop exits and it gets the right answer, right? Mm-hmm. You're never taught to think about resiliency or instead of you assume correct operation,
yeah,
instead of expecting failure at every step.
Yeah, but that's where we can really learn, yeah, from automotive and aerospace and, yeah, you know, those kind of industries where a plane won't crash just because a pilot flipped the wrong switch, yeah, right?
That's a good point. I mean, but we also have to be careful is a lot of times safety and security are conflated together.
Mm.
When you solve them completely separately. Safety can always be solved by redundancy. Security can't be solved by redundancy.
Sure,
it's solved by the redundant mitigations and multiple layers and you know, diligence, yeah, and exception handling. So we got to be careful not to necessarily. My company actually, the bigger Talus, is part of. They have large aviation wings, which I've worked with before, and I can tell you that just because they get safety doesn't mean they get anything about security.
Oh yeah, now, the attack model is different. Like safety, the attack model is modern nature.
It's attack of God, as, yeah, opposed to somebody actively poking you,
exactly,
or attaching their laptop to your seat back USB port and trying to do things to,
yeah,
you. So, it's a completely different threat model.
Lori, you have a question?
I don't think that's
working. I don't think it's working. It stopped working earlier.
To your point, so you're down at the developer level. What I'm seeing with this panel in the future of security is I'm seeing that security is starting to be more of a concern at the CTO level and in the C-suite. You're representing security companies.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing as strategically, we see a concern on the bars that the C-suite is now concerned about security. I still don't see that action is really being taken, that's cascading down to actually real action. And in fact, what I'm seeing is that there was a real emphasis on cybersecurity. It's a good buzzword, but when it actually comes to real security and implementation of real security, it still isn't there.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, in the future of security, do you see that increasing or decreasing as we proliferate more and more features and more and more end user devices?
Very, very good question. I can only speak to my experience and colleagues that I chat with. As you know, things at the C level don't move very quickly. So the first catalyst for that was liability, right? So people like in the target attack, you know, there were always CISOs in companies that was largely responsible for making sure somebody would configure the firewall, that email was, you know, had passwords on it, and, you know, that would sit in the board meetings and wear the security hat. That dramatically changed. So that, I think that got the attention of the C board. So they're starting to, you see a transition of that role from somebody who's just worried about some of the physical aspects of security or basics to being more of a CISO role, where they're actually concerned about protecting the assets. Now, has that filtered down to the lower level yet? I don't think so. I can't speak for all organizations or even mine intimately, but I have seen a change. I see a fear at the C-level. I think they know it's a hot potato and something needs to be done. I think they're circling the wagons and trying to figure out what it is, what are those things they need to put in place to limit their liability and their risk. And that's how they see it. They don't see it as a fundamental change in development process or how they build products. They look at it as risk and liability. Right.
So, you know, all the enterprises that you know, if I talk to the CISOs, so what keeps them up at night, it's all about the threat. It's all about the data and how to protect it. And that's just table stakes to do business today. It isn't like what it used to be that, you know, your data was in your perimeter, so as long as you kind of did it sort of okay, you could survive. But now that your data is now proliferating everywhere, it's just table stakes to do proper security. And businesses are deciding that security is not something for them for a competitive advantage, right? It's just a table stake. So they are looking to vendors to say, listen, I have this sensitive data. I know that it is there. Protect it for me. They're looking for a full stack, right? What they don't want is these point solutions. They get the firewall from some guy, they, you know, the authentication from somebody. They put it all together, and it's supposed to kind of magically work. That's not what they're wanting to do. So that's what the market is telling us, that they want that. Now it's up to us to actually deliver that product that way. And the commoditization of security that's happening within the cloud, so if you look at AWS or something like that, and the security stack they provide for their specific environment is arguably a lot better than what any one vendor can provide to you on-prem. Because they control everything from the firewall to the identity to data encryption to the keys, everything. And it's all integrated.
I see a lot of variance. But to give you one public data point, Apple, they're really on the security bandwagon now. Since the whole FBI hack, I mean, this is going all the way to the CEO now, right? So it really depends on in my perspective, how mature companies are and how they see, in the end, security is just risk management, right? But I'm seeing now that for some of these companies, it's becoming a sales model as well. Like, my product is more secure than yours. My iPhone is more secure than your phone X. So it's not only risk management anymore.
I think we probably have time for one more question. Go ahead, Hank.
Also about composition model. So the composition model is where you separate the platform from the application itself. So separate these two out in order to make a easier way of deploying a service, deploying the encrypted module or encrypted system separate from the things that actually go into that system. So making it where the applications can be deployed in months instead of years, as opposed to the actual module of the beacon. Now, a couple things that you said were the stacks of the higher stacks, not reliable, be careful, reliable with the lower stacks. So there seems to be complications with this kind of model that takes effect. But in in your view, do you think the separation out from the application to the low-level systems, the modules, the hardware, what have you, is the right way to go?
I think in many ways, yes. I mean, so whether, regardless of the technology you referred to, whether it's, you know, TEE or anything that comes along after that from a global platform, or you can even talk Java Card OS if you wanted to. So the idea of loading trusted applications, I think, is very important. I think that it's about managing the trust, and I think that's going to be critical to IoT or phones or anything else going out. It's the blind attestation of these particular endpoints. But what trust doesn't solve is actually the efficacy of the thing that you're loading. So even if you could keep the thing that is securely loaded and securely updated very rapidly in its own little sandbox, it doesn't talk to the quality of that thing that is running in that sandbox. It still could be poorly designed. We see it in Apple's App Store today, where one day you load an application and it's very useful. 10 months down the road, it's bought by a Chinese ad firm, and all of a sudden it's serving up a million ads, right? But it's trusted, and you let it go into your phone and do certain things. So trust is not a crutch for security. And it is very important. It's going to be critical to what we do. But I'd like to see some additional attestation that talks to the capabilities of a particular piece of trusted software rather than just did it come from this vendor or not come from this vendor. At least that's my perspective.
I don't know if either of you have anything else. We have just like a minute or two, so if you have anything else.
I would just say, you know, that it's still the humans are going to be the weakest element. From either both implementation, from a vendor, from all that, I think we've specified quite a bit that, you know, data is the new oil, so it doesn't really matter who has it. So going to your question about nations or enterprises, mm-hmm. I think it doesn't really matter who has it. Data just has one color; it's green, it's money, and if someone can figure out how to monetize that, someone's going to do that, whether that be leaking the email addresses of Ashley Madison for ransomware, I mean, who would have thought, to hacking OPM, right, to get how our intelligence is done. And until we get better at trusting humans in some way, whether that's the certification body, is that through a vendor, is that through open source?
Or eliminating them.
Rise of the Robots, or the Cylons, or the BSG fans.
Well, Uber did release their self-driving car today in Pittsburgh, so, you know, for testing. So, you know, they are starting to eliminate us one way or another.
Yeah, so I think it's a very interesting time for security, because I think we've had the advantage of things being as is for a while. And I think it's finally getting more exciting.
The world is changing us rather than us changing the world.
Excellent. Well, thanks, and thanks for the questions, and thank you to everyone here on the panel if you can show your appreciation. I really appreciate you guys. And that will mostly wrap us up in this session for today. I just want to remind you all that across the hall, we do have the wine and cheese over in the exhibit area. So go and enjoy, and we'll see you over there.
Yeah. Didn't end up the screen too much, did we?